This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to New Books in New York City History, a podcast series presented by the Gotham Center for New York City History for the New Books Network. My name is Taisha Maddox, and I'm an assistant professor at Fordham University in the Department of African and African American Studies, and I'm currently a postdoctoral fellow at Rutgers University. And today I'll be speaking with Dr. Jesse Hoffman Garskoff, who is an associate chair and professor of history and American culture at the University of Michigan. And we'll be talking about his new book, Racial Migration, New York City and the Revolutionary Politics of the Spanish Caribbean, published in 2019 by Princeton University Press. Dr. Jesse Hoffman Garskoff's first book, A Tale of Two Cities, Santo Domingo in New York after 1950. And he also has many numerous articles out, and his research areas include transnational migrations, music, race, and ethnicity. Good afternoon, Jesse. How are you?
Good. Good afternoon, Taisha. Thanks for doing this interview.
That's great. Is there anything you want to add to your bio that you want listeners to know about you and your work?
No, I mean, I guess I'll just add that I'm right now I'm the director of the Immigrant Justice Lab here at the University of Michigan, which is a little bit off topic for New York City history, although obviously it's also really important for New York City history and present. But we work with local pro bono legal providers to try and provide academic research to the benefit of clients seeking immigration to Michigan now. So that's something I'm proud of, and I wanted to just add into the record.
Oh, awesome. That's great. So I like to start on, if you could give us a brief overview of the work itself and explain to us what led you to this second project. As it seems, it's a little bit of a departure from the time frame of your first book, and it explores a completely new group of immigrants to New York.
Right. I mean, what's similar between the two projects, I think, is that they're both about New York City. They're both about about people who emigrated to New York City from the Spanish-speaking Caribbean. And so there's a clear similarity there, but they're in really different time periods. So the first book is about the period after 1950, and particularly Dominican immigrants to New York City, but also the relationship of New York City to Dominican society and politics and culture on the island. The second book is this new book, Racial Migrations, is about the 19th century. It's about the last three decades of the 19th century, and sort of pokes its head into the 20th century only very briefly. And it's about migrants from the islands of Puerto Rico and Cuba who came to the United States. Both books are similar in the sense that they take New York City history as a possibility that New York City history and their experience of migration to New York City might not just be a chapter in the broader narrative of U.S. immigration history, but might actually be a chapter in the narrative that we can tell about the histories of the islands of the Caribbean. So in each case, the books start and spend a lot of time in the Caribbean before even getting to New York to try and find out who the people are who are coming, what kinds of things are important to them, how are politics and culture percolating through their lives before they make the decision to migrate, and then tries to understand how migration to New York City, settlement in New York City, engagement with other New Yorkers transforms their experiences, political experiences, cultural experiences, social experiences. But then both books end, and this is true of Racial Migrations too, back on the islands, trying to think about what the longer term consequences are for the politics and culture of the islands of having had this migrant experience abroad. So the new book is really, it's about these 19th century migrants, and the key analytic is the central figures in the book are all people of African descent or partial African descent from the islands of Puerto Rico and Cuba. And the key analytic is, what does the experience of migrating while Black, or in some cases migrating possibly never having considered yourself Black, but seeming Black to people in the United States. What influence does that have, particularly on the ways that this group of people practice politics and assert themselves as intellectuals, and where the payoff is for this group? And it's a group of people, some of whom some of your readers may know them, but some may not, that include Rafael Serra, Juan Bonilla, Sotero Figueroa, Pachín Marín, and others. The payoff is that they end up being very important in the story of the rise to leadership of José Martí, who was also a New Yorker, although he was not of African descent. And so the payoff is, how does their experience as people born in the 1850s in these Caribbean islands, which were still places where slavery was a dominant economic and social system, and where Spanish colonialism was the governing system, how do people of African descent become intellectuals? How do they become migrants? And then what is the experience of migrating to the United States due to their choice, their political choices, particularly the choice to align themselves with José Martí?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's great. Thank you so much. So one of the things that immediately I was taken aback by when I started reading the book, one, you provide a very helpful a list of your cast of characters, which I think is really helpful. And I found myself going back to just to make sure, like, okay, I know who that is. Okay, I'm following. I got it. And then another thing that really stood out to me is that you list, not only do you list the cast of characters, but you almost have like a yearbook with the faces, with pictures of these immigrants. And it stands out that these are black people. And I wanted to know if that was intentional, putting those pictures in the beginning of the text in the way that you did. And why did you find it important to not only list these cast of characters, but to include their representations of what they look like in the beginning?
Those are wonderful questions. So, I mean, the cast of characters, I think all the questions are sort of interrelated. One of the things that I discovered as I got into this book is that I had these broad questions, but there was this unusual opportunity that I found, which is that there was a very specific group of people who had provided me with the documentary evidence during their lives to tell a story that was really personal, that was really about individual lives being lived in these contexts that I knew so much about. And I made the decision at some point that telling the stories of a handful of individual lives, and I'm not the first person to do this, but it's unusual to be able to do it in the context of Afro-Caribbean people. Hailing a handful,
especially in this period, I think, too.
Yes, especially in this period, a handful of individual lives that can be represented both by documents that were created by states or by the church, but also represented in people's own words because they were literate and articulate and had access to the printing press, was an unusual thing to do, and that I wanted to try and do it in a way that would be engaging and narratively compelling, but that was an incredibly complex thing to ask people to read. And so the cast of characters is both to emphasize that characters are the center of the story, and to really, you know, you can provide an introduction that would be an introduction about what historians should rethink about the way that we talk about things, or that would be about historiography or what people have gotten right or wrong in the past. But I really wanted to start with giving a reader the sense of what's coming. What's coming are these people, and these people, even in a brief sketch of them that you put in that cast of characters, you start to see how rich the community they created was, but also how sort of incredible and unusual they are, not because they were unusual at their time, but because they're unusual. It's unusual that their stories would come down to us. I already mentioned that I feel like part of what was really fortunate for me in sort of uncovering these stories was that I came to believe really strongly that the subjects of this book themselves made heroic and Herculean efforts to write themselves into the historical record. That is one of the main dynamics that I continually come across is and I should just say that the main characters in the book are either cigar workers, they spent their days earning wages rolling cigars, or print workers, so they spent their days organizing, setting type and printing in printing houses. And also midwives, people, women who did the work of helping other women to bear children, but also all kinds of other primary care and community-based care. they made heroic efforts to make sure that their own stories were going to be recorded, and particularly going to be recorded in ways that would be that wouldn't be easily erased. So they spent a lot of effort and time on getting writing stories about each other, publishing stories about each other, and putting into the printed record things that they felt historians needed to know. And one really wonderful example of that is that at the last thing that Rafael Serra does really as an intellectual in New York before going back to be one of the most successful Black politicians in Cuba in the early 20th century is that he publishes a book with all of those, most of those images that you mentioned. And he's the one who lines them up as almost like a yearbook. And he gets these really wonderful, very clear, gorgeous images of these beautiful people. And they are self-representations, right? These are people who made the choice to spend some money to go to have a formal seating in front of a photographer. That doesn't mean that those self-representations aren't restricted and limited by the expectations of the society around them. But it felt to me honest and reflective of the sources I was finding that this was a set of pictures that the people who I was writing about would want to be included and upfront in this book. And I also found myself looking at the pictures a lot, because as I was imagining the things that I was finding out about the people in those photographs, I kept returning to them to remind myself what these people looked like, to try and just imagine what their experience was in the spaces that I was finding them.
So in the text, and even just now in our conversation, you mentioned that you wanted this work to read more as a microhistory, of course, more like a novel than a standard or a conventional history text. And I wanted to know why that approach was important for you. Why was it important for you to tell these narratives? And in what ways were you able to construct the narratives? You mentioned Sarah taking the pictures and documenting the history. But can you talk a little bit more about your sources and maybe some of the surprising or even limiting issues that you found in doing this archival research and putting it all together?
Yeah. So, I mean, the choice to write it in this way is partly, you know, a choice that's about trying to take on a writing challenge and see if you can make it work. Yeah. And that writing challenge is, I think it's justified in a couple of ways. One is that I think that, I hope at least, and this is certainly my experience with my first book, that I never think that historians should think that we're going to have a huge audience, but I think that there's an audience for this set of stories and a group of people out there who might have uses that they would want to put these histories to that may not be eager to wade through the kinds of conversations that historians really enjoy having among ourselves, like about methodology or about historiography. And so I tried, the goal was, and it's a writing challenge, and the proof will be in the pudding. The goal was to write something that would be engaging and draw people in from outside the historical profession, or maybe students who aren't as interested in the arcane details, while still satisfying you all, the professional historians, who know what the arguments are, and hopefully you'll see that the way I tell the story communicates something about the arguments or satisfies the desire for precision or for scholarly, for scholarly following the scholarly rules. So that was the writing challenge that I wanted to set up, and I hope that it's been successful. It's obviously really hard to tell from this vantage point. In terms of the way the challenge is, I mean, one challenge is just how do you imagine and tie together the stories that you have for which you have rich documentation, right? So you have a figure like Serra, who was really an active writer and published actively from 1879, 1880, all the way through his death in 1909. And so just assembling, it's challenging but doable to assemble sort of an informal collected works and read your way through. And he left all kinds of clues about what he was thinking about and what he was feeling. And the same thing is true about Sotera Figueroa. So those are public expressions of their ideas and of their politics. And it's possible and really engaging to try and reconstruct them. When you mention challenges, though, certainly there are other key figures in the book, like Gertrudis Heredia, who was married to Rafael Serra and was a midwife, one of the midwives that I mentioned to you, and is just probably the most fascinating character in the book. She was the granddaughter of African elders in Matanzas. She grew up in a community in which her grandparents were the leaders of an African cabildo, a Lukumi cabildo. She became one of the first Black women to graduate from the University of Havana's midwifery certification program. And then she became a community leader in New York, and she was the president of all of the, or vice president of all of the women's organizations created by migrants of color from Cuba. And yet, she was literate, but she was not writing. I haven't found no instance of her writing in her own voice. There's just way less there's way less to write about and to find about her. And so the challenge has been how to really represent through storytelling and through, you know, creative reconstruction, the audacious projects imagined by Black and brown men from the Spanish-speaking Caribbean in this period, while recognizing that many of those projects made invisible or silenced the active participation of Black and brown women, and trying not to reproduce that by simply going with the best material. So I tried to force myself, but I did face challenges to, if not find equal or a totally balanced presentation, to really find ways to get into the stories of the women in these communities who were evidently, to me, equally important in creating the community and in imagining the politics. But if you just followed the printed record, would be almost totally invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely women. I was going to ask you, that's a question that was going to come up. In what ways were women influential or present in these historiographies?
Yeah, well, so I mean, you know, just thinking this through, the role of midwives, because Gertrudis wasn't the only midwife. Then that was one of the things that I discovered as I was doing this research, is that in fact, there were two women, Josefa Blanco and Gertrudis Heredia, who were the leaders of most of the women's groups that formed in New York, including groups that ended up being part of, you know, forming political clubs and joining the Cuban Revolutionary Party as party members, as voting members of the party. They were both midwives, and I thought that can't be a coincidence.
Yeah.
But then one of the real questions about that I'm trying to pose in especially in the middle chapters of the book, what are the kinds of communities that migrants create to contend with the issues that they face as migrants, migrants of color, right? So if we understand that migrating while Black produces some kinds of challenges that all migrants face, but also some additional challenges if you're moving into a space of racial domination that's not necessarily familiar. You have to figure out where to eat, where you can rent a house, where you can find work, whom you can marry, what kinds of spaces you can move through, and you want to do that while avoiding indignity, but also possibly while avoiding violence, in depending on what society you're in. In the chapters where I'm trying to ask that question, how do people find housing? How do they find other things? What I came to was, well, actually, you need to figure out how to give birth to children. And, you know, because people are pregnant and people are giving birth to children, that's a serious issue to try and resolve. And it seems to be being resolved partly by Cuban doctors who are part of the much more elite Cuban community in other parts of the city, but but also partly by Cuban midwives, women of color. And so trying to think that backwards and think, well, of course, it doesn't seem that surprising that women would be elected to certain leadership positions if they're already involved in helping to resolve some of the most important and urgent issues in the everyday lives of migrant communities. Who helps women who are in labor, who attends to women's health and to children's health, and then who do you turn to if you need a referral to a doctor or if you need to have contact with somebody else in the medical community? And I think that the role that women played in doing that really helped to consolidate the community, because the second part of the question is, so first part of the question is, what do migrants who are identified by others as African descended need, specially in order to manage the problems of migration? The second part is, how do those communities that or organizations that they create to do that, how did it then become the ground for politics? And this is, I think, interesting to you because of your work, right? Mm-hmm. How do social clubs become the basis for political action?
And
by the 1890s, it's clear that the very same networks that were created basically to survive the problems of migration are turn their attention to politics. And by the early 1890s, not only have they turned their attention to politics, my argument is they become the first and in some ways the strongest network of political supporters that propel José Martí into leadership. So it's a pre-existing communal and political network that then choose Martí and propel him forward.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get back to that, but first I want to ask you, just what role does New York City, do you think, play in this text and maybe in some of those political decisions that they make later on?
Yeah, I mean, so it's an interesting question, right? So this is for a New York City blog, so I can push it in that direction. But so, I mean, a question that a Cubanist might ask, right? The flip side of it is there are more Cubans, especially more Cubans of color and more working class Cubans in Florida. There are quite a few in New Orleans. There are a lot in Veracruz, Mexico. So why New York? Why the focus on New York? Part of the reason is because New York has this sort of special place in Cuba, in Cuban history, because of the role that New York has in U.S. empire in the Caribbean region, right? So the banks are in New York, the merchant trading houses are in New York, the sugar refining companies are in New York, the biggest cigar market at the time is in New York. So wealthy Cubans had already, by the time the main characters in my story come to New York, wealthy Cubans had already basically had second homes in New York and were doing all kinds of business there, which meant that when wealthy Cubans became involved in nationalist politics and trying to renegotiate the colonial relationship with Spain, the center of that political life was in New York City. So when working class Cubans and Cubans of color wanted to intervene in that politics, even though there might have been fewer of them in New York, they were very successful at projecting themselves into the center of the politics because they were close by. They were part of this multi-class national community. And in fact, one of the other arguments is that the fights that they had about what a multi-class national community abroad would look like mapped right on to the fights that they were having about what they thought a future Cuban nation should look like. So that's one of the things that I think is really interesting. The other thing that's really interesting, and I don't think this is limited to New York, but it's specific in New York in this story, is that New York was a place of really interesting African-American politics at this time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a particularly really interesting African-American politics from the perspective of Cubans and Puerto Ricans, because New York was a city with very small black population in this period, 20,000, something like that, black people in a city of a million, maybe up to 40,000 by the end of the period of my study. But those folks were concentrated in specific neighborhoods, and they were the same neighborhoods and the same apartment buildings that the Cubans and Puerto Ricans of African descent were living in. So they were not a very large community, but they were very much present in the same spaces that the Caribbeans were in. And they were involved in similar kinds of politics almost at the same time. They were trying to imagine how the specific publications that they were leading from their capital cities, either Havana or San Juan, or here in New York, which was sort of a cultural capital, might help to convert, to transform and create a national movement around black advancement. And then they were also... New York State was an interesting place because it was a place that had specific laws on the books that prevented racial discrimination in public accommodations, which is unusual in the United States in the 1890s. But those rules were not followed. And so the African-American activists in New York, one of the things that they were doing was to try and take lawsuits against individual proprietors of restaurants or hotels if they broke those laws, to try and get the state to intervene. And that's exactly the same thing that the Spanish subjects of the Caribbean were doing, because by the 1880s, the Spanish crown had said, you can no longer discriminate in public facilities, yet nobody was enforcing that law. So at the very same time, they were developing really similar strategies. And out of that, I think they start to have really interesting conversations about party politics, about legal avenues, and about the balance between creating national civil rights organizations or simply participating in party politics.
So that's another question I was going to get to, and asking what connections did these Cuban and Puerto Rican immigrants have with the African American communities, because many of them were living in the same neighborhood. They sometimes shared the same jobs, and there might have been, I'm wondering if there were overlap in their organizations and maybe some of the clubs, if there were connections amongst them. And then also other West Indian immigrants who were also coming at this time. I know the Anglophone, from my own work, the Anglophone West Indian immigrant groups were also creating their own clubs and societies at this time. And you make mention of William Drake, the pastor of the Bethel AME Church, and how he was inviting these Cuban and Puerto Rican immigrants to come to services and connect with people in that way. What other connections are forged during this time?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the answer is yes. There are definitely connections, and that's a thing that I at the beginning of the project I was surprised by, but by the end it just seems so clear. The first set of connections are made either through churches or also through fraternal organizations. Mm-hmm. So when I speak of the kinds of associational life and community building that was necessary for Black immigrants in this period, mm-hmm. A lot of that associational life takes place in the context of a broader Black civil society in New York. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when Germán Sandoval, who's one of the early kind of pioneers for Black Cuban pioneers in New York, creates the Logia San Manuel, a fraternal lodge. That's for Cubans. It's for Cubans of color, although I presume that they eventually will allow white Cubans, if they want to come in, Mm-hmm. Most don't choose to. But it's a fraternal. It's a branch of the Grand United Order of the Odd Fellows, which is a Black. Mm-hmm. A Black fraternal organization and a really important part of Black civil society, Black male civil society in the period after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And the Cubans have contact with it because they create chapters both in Key West and in New York. Mm-hmm. And they basically translate all of the kind of the lodge rituals and all the paperwork into Spanish. And so they're really, when they're creating their own institutions, they're doing so relying on their contact with African Americans. And the same thing happens when they create their first Masonic lodges in mm-hmm. New York and in South Florida. And here again, the chicken and the egg question is really important, right? Is it that they have contact in these social in these associational contexts and fraternal orders, and then they build social contacts out of them, or do they have social contacts first? And my conclusion about the Masonic lodge that gets created in 1880 in New York by Black Cubans, and eventually for Black Cubans and Puerto Ricans, is that many of the people who created that lodge already had substantial ties, personal ties to African Americans. They were married to African American women, mm-hmm. so they had African American male brothers-in-law. Sometimes they were living in mixed apartments with African Americans, oftentimes mm-hmm. isomerized, working in the same contexts. And so there's a way in which when they create a Spanish-speaking Prince Hall Lodge, Prince Hall being the grand lodge for African American Masons, mm-hmm. they do it relying on the resources that they have from their relationships with African Americans, but they also are gesturing that they want to be not just African Americans, that they have something particular that they want to do with only Spanish speakers. They want to create a space that both overlaps with Black civil society, but also is their own in a certain way. Those two spaces, the two lodges, are really key examples for me of the community building that precedes the politics of the 1880s and 1890s. So then as that politics develops, the contact between Black newspaper editor, African American newspaper editors, and Black Cuban newspaper editors who are working within a few blocks of each other in New York is extensive, and you can see that they're translating for Cuban audiences pieces that they pick up from the Black press in the United States. And by the same token, some of the Cubans start to send information about what's happening both in the Cuban community in New York, but also in Cuba itself, to the Black press in the United States. So they early on as migrants start to see themselves as go-betweens between national community, you know, between diasporic communities. Mm-hmm. And see the printing press and the distribution of newspapers as a way of doing that. And I actually think that's one of the reasons why they invest so much money in taking photographs and then creating reliable plates that can mm-hmm. use to print them in a high quality way. Because once you have those photographs and plates, it's much easier to suggest to a newspaper editor, hey, I've written this sketch about this important man of color from Cuba, and here's a great image of him. Would you mm-hmm. include it? And you see this in their personal correspondence, that the editors are saying, I'm working on a book or a series about important African-American intellectuals. I understand that there are some in Cuba too. Would you be willing to contribute something? And would you be willing to lend me a photograph of this person that I know of? And they're kind of passing that information back and forth.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So a question that I often get, and I'm going to pose it to you, I'm sure you've gotten it before, is when writing about these Black immigrants in this period, people are very surprised about how mobile they are. And when we look at your cast of characters, some of them are moving from Havana to, you mentioned Key West, to New York, to Cologne, and then you even mentioned Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So how are they allowed this mobility? You coined the term, you mentioned it in the book and just now, migrating while Black, and then also migrating while colored. And yeah. what do you mean by that, and what are the implications of that?
Well, so for the first question, I think that it's really interesting, and I also get these questions. People are surprised also that that mm-hmm. the character in my book can just show up at a courthouse and say, yeah. "I want to be a U.S. citizen," and the judge says, "Oh, okay," and then like 2 weeks later, they're voting in a federal election, right?
Yeah.
So that seems really surprising, and I think that there are a couple ways of attacking this. One way of attacking it is to think that our current mode of extreme hostility to the mobility of people is something that has evolved significantly since then. Though I should say that this is directly in the middle of the period when especially Chinese immigrants are in the crosshairs. So it's not that there weren't racialized restrictions on mobility in this period. So then the question is why, given that we know that the history of anti-Blackness in this country and in many parts of the Caribbean, why is it that in this particular moment Blackness isn't a more powerful restriction on mobility, given that states are starting to imagine the restrictions on mobility and given that there's plenty of anti-Blackness? And I think part of the answer to that is that the Caribbean is such a mobile society to start with that it takes a while to get the technologies to start cracking down on it. But part of it is that the migrants that I'm looking at are coming in the tail end of Reconstruction. And there actually are real legal measures during Reconstruction that matter to preserve this mobility. So for instance, in 1870, anti-racists in Congress try and get the white prerequisite to naturalization out of the U.S. statute. Since the beginning of the Republic, you could only become a naturalized citizen if you were white, a free white person. But in the period of the 14th Amendment and the other Reconstruction piece of legislation, anti-racists say, well, we should take that out. We should just say you can become a citizen if you're a free person. And there's a lot of back and forth about it. And the anti-Chinese folks end up winning the day and saying, no, you can't take white out, because if we take white out, then we'll make room for Chinese people to become citizens. But the compromise is, well, we'll let people of African descent and African nativity become citizens. And literally within a couple of months, there are Cubans applying for citizenship, Black Cubans applying for citizenship. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an afterthought in most U.S. immigration history, but it's really important around this question of mobility. And the other thing is to recognize what I think you know, and what Laura Putnam I think has written about really beautifully and powerfully, mm-hmm. is just how dramatically the 1924 immigration legislation cut off mobility for Black migrants.
Yeah.
And not just that piece of legislation, but all of the nationalist immigration reforms of the 1920s and the 1930s really, really struck a devastating blow to a migrant world that was really active and in which blackness was not, did not preclude mobility. In the greater Caribbean, that there's all the Latin American societies that border the Caribbean, as well as the United States. It just wasn't the case in the 1890s and the early 20th century that there was that kind of restriction based on blackness. I think there was a second part of the question. I'm forgetting it now.
I asked the term that you phrased, migrating while black. Oh, right. What were some of the implications, but I think you answered that pretty well.
Sure.
And then another question I had, I wanted to get to these organizations, to the La Lingua, to talk about it a little bit. Can you explain the differences? Because a lot of these terms come up, the Masonic Lodge, the Cabildo de Nacion, Mutual Aid Society, Society de Color. What are the differences in these organizations, and were there some overlaps? What were their goals?
Right. So formally, you've listed a bunch of different things. Formally, organizational life or associational life for Black and Brown people in the Spanish Caribbean, there were kind of a couple of traditional ways of doing that up until the late 19th century. One was a Cabildo de Nación, which was actually permission to be ethnically African. They were state permitted. They were licensed, and they were usually created by African born people who had become free, which is a whole interesting story of its own. And then oftentimes they were used as tools to actually save money and get other folks free. So they were already mutual aid societies in a basic level, but they are the spaces in which are, you know, the current, you know, contemporary even to today, Afro-Cuban cultural expressions such as Afro-Cuban music, Afro-Cuban spiritual practice and philosophical practice were built and consolidated as new waves of captives came in from Africa, but as Cuban-born generations continued to keep alive the kinds of philosophical, spiritual, and political arrangements that they had created. So that's a Cabildo de Nación. There are also religious confraternities. I don't really focus on those very much in the colonial period. And then by the end of the 19th century, especially in Cuba, there's a lot of pressure on Black communities to give up Africanness. And at the same time, there's a promise from some of the leading political parties, as well as from the colonial government, that that there may be some space eventually for Black political participation in and citizenship, and whether that's citizenship in as Spanish citizens or whether that's citizenship as Cuban citizens in an independent Cuba, it is still very much up in the air. In fact, it's not really safe to talk about an independent Cuba, but there is this promise, and that promise creates a situation in which the government encourages Black organizers to create these new kinds of clubs, sociedades de color, or colored societies. And they tend to be urban workers, urban, relatively well off compared to the majority of the rural, you know, formerly enslaved people who are working still cutting sugarcane. They're urban, they're craftspeople, and they organize social clubs, which are places where you can have dances, where you can... So those sociedades de color are the spaces of an emerging Black civil rights movement in the late 19th century, as well as the first the largest boom in Black periodicals. So newspapers oftentimes those clubs will have a newspaper affiliated with them, and they'll oftentimes also have a school, because one of the big civil rights projects of that generation, the generation that came of age right around the end of slavery. So slavery is the law that is going to abolish slavery in Cuba is passed in 1880, and then it's finally enacted by the end of 1886. In that period, the generation of civil rights activists, they really are advocating for free and universal education. And in the meantime, they use their clubs to raise money to be able to provide free education to students who can't afford, who don't have access to public education and can't afford private education. So that's a lot of the folks who come to New York and then create the movement in New York are veterans of that project. They've both been involved in the clubs, in the civil rights politics, and also in the publications. Now, you asked about Masonic lodges. So Masonic lodges are all male. They are secret. They have a significant element of sort of ritual within them, and that's secret. So there's initiation. There's there's secret knowledge that's passed only on to initiates, which actually is not so different from the cabildos, but the content is different. It's not African, necessarily African content. We actually don't know all of the content. And in the Cuban context, there are some Masonic lodges that are mixed, that are mixed race, and there are some that are not. But all of them are run by white Cubans, right? So there might be some where the white Cubans are relatively open to accepting black Cubans in, and there are others that are not. But they're all mostly run by white Cubans. And so one of the interesting things that happens is that the black Cubans in New York, and then also in South Florida, they sometimes participate in those mixed race social institutions for Cubans, but they also sometimes create their own Masonic lodges. Was there another kind of?
And then the La Lengua, is it a convergence of all of these together, or do they create, are they creating something new?
Yeah. So La Liga, it's created in at the end of the 1880s in New York, and I think it's very similar in many ways to the Sociedades de Color on the island. It has a project of education. It does offer a free school. It's about, it really is dedicated to a project of social uplift. It's a little bit different because the aspirations of the people who create it are higher at that point. So it's not about basic education for people who are illiterate, which is the way a lot of the clubs are really operating in Cuba. But it's about actually trying to find resources, intellectual resources and training to promote men of color, as they described it themselves, from Cuba and Puerto Rico into the professions that they're not represented in. So it's taking people who already are, who are probably craftsmen but have a relatively high level of basic education, and trying to help them to think about how to become journalists, intellectuals, and other professions, teachers, and other professions. The other thing that the La Liga does, which is unusual from with respect to what's going on in the island, is that it becomes a center for political organizing. And I think actually even in the name, it sort of is hinting at an idea that this is going to be the case, because at the very same time La Liga is formed, the New York African Americans are creating something that they call the Afro American League, which is going to be a national civil rights organization that's going to work to help organize and put pressure on political parties. And so I think La Liga is in some ways parallel to that. And the idea is there'll be lots of these clubs all around. There'll be one in Key West and several in Cuba, and they'll all dedicate themselves to promoting black leadership in a kind of a new way, by training black men to have the skills to be leaders, but also by promoting by being unified and promoting putting a unified face towards the political class. The other thing that becomes really unusual about La Liga is that Serra, when he creates it, he recruits Jose Martí to be a supporter of the project, and out of that develops a really unusual relationship. The La Liga ends up actually becoming a political club in all but name that supports the early efforts of Jose Martí to assert himself as the leader of the independence movement abroad. You had a follow-up question.
Yeah, so I was going to say, La Liga, were there spaces for women to be involved in that organization? And then were there, I guess, maybe like branches or connections with, like you mentioned, in Key West, like organizations also forming around the same time in Key West?
Yeah. So yes. So there are spaces for women to be involved, but I think, as I mentioned before, they're not always inscribed in the public record. Right. So the founders are thought of as being men. And that's one of the things, one of the other reasons why I like those photographs at the beginning of the book. Despite the fact that the founders are shown as being men, the members are represented as men and women. There's this wonderful sort of photo montage of the ladies of La Liga. And as I worked more and more into the project, I realized actually I knew who these women were, and I could find out lots about them. And so there are clearly spaces for women to be there. And in fact, by the end of the project, I feel like even the times when it's supposed to be only men, there probably were women and children in these spaces always. And that the idea of the formal division of private and public sphere is something that works really well on paper, but that in actual life and practice wasn't going on. That there were that I think sometimes at political meetings where only men are listed as participants, I'm pretty sure there are women there too. It doesn't usually happen. It actually may happen the other way around. When there are women's groups meetings, there may be men there too. But for the most part, it's about, it's about having the disciplined imagination to recognize the clues that suggest that in fact, well beyond what is indicated on paper, women are present. And it actually corresponds really well with Elsa Barkley Brown's argument about women in African-American politics at this point, that there's a kind of a public-facing African-American politics that face towards white folks that is overwhelmingly male in the way that it represents black politics, but that in the conversations that black folks are having among themselves around politics, conventions, meetings, women are active, vocal participants, and really necessary for the democratic for the democratic functioning of those organizations. I think something similar is going on at La Liga.
And then, so you mentioned a little bit earlier, and I want to go back to it, that in it's in the 1890s that we see this turn to politics. What's happening in this period? We know, but I'd like you to express it more. What's happening in this period that we see this change?
So, let me just specify. I think it's a new form of politics. So I think that even from the beginning of the story back in the late 1860s and 1870s, there's always a politics, but the politics at that point is a politics of rebellion on the island, right? There was a anti-slavery, anti-colonial rebellion going on in the eastern part of the island. And so the politics was really about the being involved in a project to raise funds in support of that movement. But that politics was dominated by wealthy white Cubans. And there wasn't really, it wasn't really structured around what we think of as sort of modern party structures. It was basically a kind of a group of notables who would call meetings together and were sort of self-appointed as the leaders of the Cuban community. So the other alternative for working class Cubans and for Cubans of color in those early years and straight through the 1880s was simply to volunteer for military service. That was its own kind of politics. And in fact, Rafael Serra did that in 1888. He ended up never making it to Cuba, but he followed the African-descended general, Antonio Maceo, and other African-descended generals into battle. The plan was to follow them into battle and to really do the politics of equality through launching a revolution against slavery and in favor of equal rights. What's different about the 1890s is the way that long-standing set of political goals and the long-standing political ideology that had been articulated within them get transposed onto a new kind of organization, which is a party structure in which there's universal suffrage. Any man who joins the party will have a vote as to who's the party leadership. And therefore, party leaders really, as they set this up, set themselves up to be dependent upon the opinions of working class migrants and migrants of color. And Martí is really savvy about this, but I think he's savvy about it because he's guided by this pre-existing set of social networks. That if he establishes a democratic process for choosing leadership and he outflanks his rivals for leadership by becoming popular with the larger number of working class migrants, then he can assure himself a place at the head of the movement. And so he sets up a movement which grants a lot of power to working class migrant clubs to choose who's going to be the leadership to his own benefit. And that's when all those Masonic lodges and clubs, and in South Florida, labor unions, you know, mutual aid societies and labor unions, they all shift, and they you know, one by one, groups like La Liga start to splinter off and create political clubs, which they can use then to support Martí's leadership in the party. And I found it really kind of eye-opening to watch that process happen, because it's oftentimes been thought of as being something that Martí created and then later went and appealed to working class, to populate, right? So that in some ways, Martí's appeal was already prefabricated by Martí and then later presented to working class and Afro-descended people as a kind of a fait accompli. But in fact, it seems to be something that was built simultaneously by Mark D and those constituents. And it actually, once they built it, and I would say that there were some similar processes going on the island, actually both islands with the political parties that are emerging there. But once all of these political parties build a set of assumptions around Black participation and working class participation, they end up not even when they want to undo it, they are not able to. And the first decades of the 20th century in Cuba, only 12 years after the end of slavery, there's universal manhood suffrage, and all the parties have to appeal to Black voters. It doesn't solve the problem of racism, but it does create a real difference between how Cuban politics work in that period and how African-American politics, how U.S. politics work, where African-Americans are being systematically excluded from voting.
Yeah. So I think one thing that really stood out is how transnational this story is, even in the structuring of the book, how you start in the Caribbean and then you come to the U.S. and then you move back and forth pretty seamlessly, I think, between Cuba and Puerto Rico and New York and Key West. And I think it's really amazing the ways in which these men are able to influence these transnational politics in both Cuba and Puerto Rico. And I wanted to know, how were these men who were so obviously of African ancestry allowed entree into this public square and allowed to set these terms, And what were some of the limitations that they had?
Yeah.
Is it because they had the backing, or because Marti is part of the organization or gives some relevancy to it? Is that why they're allowed? What do you think it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that's the central question, right? I think because it is easy to be amazed at their successes. But it's also really important to describe the constraints. And to understand that their self-assertions are self-assertions that are made within constraints. It's not like there's endless opportunities to be a Black leader in these contexts. There are specific contexts in which specific Black people can become leaders. They're significant contexts. They're contexts that agile and creative Black thinkers and activists make use of in ways that nobody ever had imagined, but they are specific. So, for example, one would be the abolitionist movement in both, mostly in Puerto Rico, but then eventually in Cuba too, has space, just as the abolitionist movement in the United States has space for Frederick Douglass. The abolitionist movements in those places have space for both comrades, but also examples of Black masculinity that are non-threatening, right? So that on the one hand, they want people who can show that the perfectibility of Black men and the ability to attain education and to participate in politics, because that's congenial to the politics that they're trying to convince everyone else of. But those white liberals also don't want too radical an approach. They don't want too assertive an approach, and so those kinds of constraints are there. They also want accomplices in giving a message out to Black pop people to be patient and to be willing to wait for certain kinds of things that they deserve. They also really
sounds familiar,
right? Of course, and of course, normative sexuality is a huge part of this. And we could I think that this is another place where African American the really good work in African-American studies, particularly in African-American women's history around respectability politics and dissimulation are really useful here, right? That is, all respectability politics are not exactly the same, and there's lots of local context, but it's clearly true that if you want to take the limited space that there is available to be a representative of the class of color, and you want to put yourself forward as a dignified and honorable Black male citizen, you have to buy into civilization, all kinds of civilizational logics that you may or may not believe, right? You may enjoy African music, you may African-Cuban music, you may love to dance, but you can't necessarily say that out loud. You also might not believe that, but you also have to really sometimes stand up and say, oh, our communities and our families are not behaving properly in terms of sexuality, whether or not you believe that. And those are problematics that I can't fully untangle from this distance.
One question I had, or one of the final questions I have, because we have to wrap it up soon, is In what ways would you say, or would you say that these groups, these men in La Liga, did they espouse like diasporic, like African diasporic ideals? Were mm-hmm. they in a way developing a like African diasporic worldview?
Yeah. Yes, I think that they were. I think that mm-hmm. I think that this is something that I've been trying to think through for many years, because mm-hmm. the way that I came into this project was that I started working on the figure of Arturo Schomburg, who was mm-hmm. part of this community, and then of course became a collector and bibliographer and art historian who really helped to be an architect for the idea that we have, current idea we have of a black diaspora, including through the creation of this archive that people, you know, that we all rely on at the Schomburg Center. And I started out thinking that Schomburg had sort of evolved towards an idea of a black diaspora out of mm-hmm. what had originally been a real, basically just a nationalist concern. But mm-hmm. actually, having read Frank Garrity's book and really thought through other people's work on this, and then spending time back in the 19th century, it seems to me that the two things evolve simultaneously, right? That all those contacts with other people of color, first of all, Cubans and Puerto Ricans together, who are actually already engaging in diasporic conversations. When
yes.
Cubans of color mm-hmm. and Puerto Ricans of color get together, they're both Spanish subjects, but they're mm-hmm. meeting and comparing black experiences across in context of migration. And mm-hmm. then the time that they spend with African Americans and with West Indians in New York, the time that they spend in Panama with West Indians in Panama, the time that they mm-hmm. spend in Jamaica, the time that they spend in Haiti, the time that they spend in Santo Domingo, provides them with a comparativist frame. They start to develop ideas and oftentimes express their own plans and projects within the national frame mm-hmm. from a comparative perspective. And at the same time, it generates a need to collect information about communities abroad, because migrating while black, there is no green book, right? Mm-hmm. There is no TripAdvisor to tell you which hotels stay, right?
Yeah.
Or what the rules for race are in this new mm-hmm. city that you're going to arrive in. And so mm-hmm. a lot of the collecting of names, kind of diasporic collection of information about other communities, looks a lot in the early years like a Rolodex. Like, this is mm-hmm. an outstanding man of color who you might contact if you're ever in this place. And I feel sure that's directed at migrants who are anticipating that they might be going to new places. Mm-hmm. But also out of that, there's in all of the, a lot of the publishing, especially as Cubans go back at the end of the war, they're doing a lot of publishing to try and insert themselves into historical narrative of the independence movement, because they know the people who are recognized as having this historically part of the movement are going to be the people who reap the benefits of the movement in the new era. There's a real symbolic battle about that. Mm-hmm. And at the same, they almost always at the same time take the opportunity to point out that it's not just black Cubans contributing to Cuba, but in fact that they have a diasporic perspective, which is to say, we also need to highlight the fact that there are really important African Americans who are contributing to the political life of the United States, and that mm-hmm. there are black Frenchmen who are contributing to the greatness of France, and that mm-hmm. Venezuela and Puerto Rico and Mexico and Brazil all have leading black figures, both to make an argument that globally blackness is part of modernity and civilization, but also I think because they believe that their the individual and national projects of equality depend on an international movement for equality. So I think that there really is a kind of a black internationalism that's coeval with, or that works together with, the nationalism that's so prominent. Mm-hmm. And I actually was surprised to find that the first Pan-Africanist congresses that happen in 1900 and shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. there aren't Cubans there. And I think it's mm-hmm. really only because their country has been occupied by the United States, and they're so focused on the here and now that they have to try and figure out how to get U.S. occupiers out and how to assert mm-hmm. themselves in the constitutional process. And so there's this kind of like really interesting gap right at the beginning of those interesting Pan-Africanist and diasporic institutional framings, where Cubans mm-hmm. are relatively absent, but wouldn't have been 10 years before and won't be 10 years after.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I really enjoyed this conversation so much. And I guess the final question I have, is, what do you want readers to take away from this text in reading it? What do you want us to learn from this? Or what's the major takeaway for
us? Well, I mean, obviously, I will say this, that one of, having written my first book, which was my dissertation, and really kind of the thing that I learned how to be a historian on, having been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to write a book about the experience of Dominican migrants in the second half of the 20th century, I'm glad that it helped me to establish my career as an academic. But the thing that makes me that both surprises me, but also is continually the most gratifying, is every time that I happen to meet someone who identifies themselves as a Dominican immigrant who was the first person in their family to go to college. And when they got to college, they were looking for something that might be helpful to them and trying to think about how they fit into the histories they were reading about. And they found in my book, and and they appreciated it. That's the thing that is the most, that makes this the work that I do as a historian the most rewarding, that it would be meaningful to people who see themselves in the stories. And so I've written this, I mean, this gets back to the question of why write it as a story, right? I've written this book thinking that obviously it would be wonderful if New York historians take it seriously and if the historical profession takes it seriously, but that if it can be something that's meaningful for people who are trying to make meaning out of their own experience in the 21st century as Black and Latino, Black or Latino, involved in coalition building, that's the most important thing. And I don't have a particular message except make use of this in the way that it makes sense to you. You know, I've tried to do the work to think about how it might make sense to me, but I really hope that, you know, activists, artists, students, you know, everyday people can find them way to these stories, because I do think that there is an interesting and growing Afro-Latino movement, both outside of the academy and inside the academy. And there's just not a lot of sources back this far to draw on.
Absolutely. And I will say, I have used your text and some of your articles in class, and at Fordham, I do have a large group of Dominican students, or students who have Dominican descent, and they definitely find themselves in the book, and they're really excited about reading about their history and having it represented in a classroom setting. So it definitely does that work. And I know this new book will also do that work as well. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And thank you again for joining us today for this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for organizing it.